Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There were three ravens sat on a tree. Down a down, hey, down a down. They were as black as they might be with a down. One of them said to his mate, "Where shall we our breakfast take? With a down, dairy, 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 down, down."
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Three Ravens podcast, this one dedicated to the runners-up in our Folky Flash fiction competition.
Very exciting times.
Yeah, very exciting indeed. And if you haven't been following, the stories we're reading today were all written by members of the Three Ravens community to a fairly tight brief. They had to be 1,000 words long about something folkloric, and they had to be emailed through to us at threeravenspodcast@gmail.com.
And it's worth saying that some people who did send entries through, sadly, we couldn't include your tales as you went way, way over the word count. In some instances, over twice the length that we were looking for. And even though some of those stories were really good, I'm sorry, but rules are rules.
They are. And it's also worth saying that we had dozens of entries for this contest. They ranged wildly. We had extracts from longer works and ghost stories, pieces of local lore and full-on original creation myths. And while we won't be reading everyone's entries, please know that we had a wonderful time reading them all and talking about them as we drew up our list of winners and our list of runners-up.
As you'll hear from this episode, there were some super runner-up entries and picking between the stories was really tricky. Mm-hmm. But next week, we'll release an episode containing all the winning stories. So as good as this clutch of tales is, we suggest that next week you're in for even more treats.
Quite right. And also, we both have to say a huge thank you to everyone who took the time to write something and enter our first ever Folky Flash Fiction Contest. We know that writing short stories can be really difficult and that putting your work out there can be genuinely nerve-wracking.
Yes. I mean, we're nervous pretty much every time we put out a new episode of Three Ravens. Yeah. So believe us when we say we get it.
Which is why it's important that everyone who entered understands how much we appreciate you having taken the plunge and risked exposing your writing to the world. It's a brave thing to do, and we're very thankful that you made the leap.
And also, we're planning a new writing contest, which will take place during Series 4. So more news on that is coming soon. Mm-hmm. But for now, let's crack on and read the stories from our wonderful runners-up.
Definitely. And before we crack on, actually, we have a brand new Patreon exclusive episode coming out on Thursday. This one about three lost villages from our home county of Sussex.
Yes, we spent a day getting quite lost looking for them and getting blown all over the place because it was extremely windy.
It was, but it was a fascinating adventure. And if you're interested in that and would like to support the podcast while also unlocking tons of other exclusive content, please sign up to our Patreon for $3 a month or $6 a month at patreon.com/ /Three Ravens Podcast.
New Three Ravens Film Club movie for this month is also Alex Garland's 2022 folk horror movie, Men. So if you'd like to join in with our Film Club episode for April, then do watch Men and email us your thoughts by Monday the 22nd for inclusion in the episode recording.
Now, we have 7 stories to read for this episode. And as with haunting season, I think we should decide who goes first with a coin flip.
Do it. And also, it's worth saying, these stories are in no particular order. We just thought they'd sound nice this way.
Okay, Eleanor. Call it.
Heads.
It's tails, meaning I'm going first. Huzzah! The Gloucester Ghoul by Eric Scarina. Sometimes work's too much and you have to take a personal day. Sometimes your apartment's too much and you have to get an Airbnb near the beach at short notice and with not much money, so of course it's not near the beach at all. Sometimes the majesty of the sound off Napa Tree Point is too much, and the murmuring of the waves too mesmerizing so that you stay there even as the dark clouds move in. And by the time you get back to your car, it's already dark and you're already soaked. Sometimes the internet's not working when you need it most, and you have to drive slowly down an undulating New England road in the dark, squinting at every street sign and driveway marker. You know you're supposed to turn left off Dunn's Corner Road onto Fletcher Drive, but Google has not updated your position in at least 5 minutes. You know you're supposed to turn left off Dunn's Corner Road onto Fletcher Drive, but Google has not updated your position in at least 5 minutes. Beside the road crawl red mailboxes and deeply recessed houses lurking behind towering trees, for at night, all trees tower. You come to a T-junction with Fern Drive and sigh, scraping your index fingernail across the side of your thumb. You've gone too far. You consider driving onwards and stopping at the hotel you saw on the way out here, Aqua something, and your anxiety spikes at the expense and at the thought of showing up unannounced. You consider driving all the way back to your apartment, and your anxiety spikes even more. You turn around. Now, going even slower, you have given up looking for Fletcher Street's sign and now focus on the mailboxes and house markers. You are in the process of turning down one likely road before the beams of your headlights fall on the address board amidst the bushes, revealing it's a driveway. You back out and stop completely on the side of the road, imagining yourself blundering about outside some stranger's house, searching for the combo box with the key. The rain begins to abate, the torrent streaming down your windshield, slowly reducing to a tap, tap, tap. It's only when you see the flash of headlights in your rearview mirror that you realize you're blocking the road. You wince at a low metallic grinding sound as your car scrapes against branches, imagining the repair costs. You stop but realize that something's wrong. You can still hear the grinding. In fact, it's getting louder. The car behind you doesn't pass. It slowly advances directly towards you. In your rearview mirror, you notice 2 things. First, that the headlights creeping up behind you are circular, with a slight hooding at the top. It's like a car from the 40s. Second, the headlights are a touch yellow, and you see the occasional flicker. Maybe even older than the 40s, though how someone got a Model T running this day and age is beyond you. The grinding's getting louder, now more of a scraping, like 1,000 rusted metal knives sliding across each other. You find your index fingernail digging into the flesh of your thumb. You can't even make out the silhouette of the car's roof, only the jagged outline of tree branches. Maybe the car's so old that they're in more trouble than you are. You decide to move out of the way. Your hand shakes as it grasps the gear shift. You pull it towards drive, but with a twitch, you let go of it too soon, leaving your car in reverse. Your backup camera flares to light on your dashboard, and it takes a moment to even grasp what you're seeing. It's not an ancient car that's creeping up behind you, but an ancient creature. It's not the light of two headlights that's been blinding your vision, but two burning yellow eyes. The thing is built like a great auroch, but with a mouth of razor teeth and twisted spiral horns you had confused for tree branches. You're frozen for a moment, your hand scrabbling at the gear shift. The creature blinks, and your hand closes on the release button. The beast roars, and you pull your car into drive. You get a last view of the monster's face as it bears down on you before the backup camera shuts off, and then you're accelerating like mad. Your tires tear at the grass and shriek at the asphalt. Your rearview mirror fills with angry light, then dims as you pick up speed. Even above the sound of your motor, you hear the clanking grinding of the beast. You accelerate too much, and as Dunn's Corner Road bends under you, you catch a pool of water and go skidding, your car turning sideways, its rear wheels sliding off down the road. Your head hits the window, and your vision goes white for an instant. The right window fills with blazing orange as the beast bears down on you. Then it passes, its body lit by the full force of your headlights, and you see the source of the grinding sound. The beast's hide is covered in a series of glinting metal scales the size of bread slices, each scraping against one another as the creature lopes past you and off down the road, crashing into the trees. Your head aches, and you're too stunned to do anything but listen as the sounds of breaking branches disappear from your ears. Then the grinding, too. You sit there for a long time, then put in your address into Google Maps. Sometimes the outdoors are too much, and you must return home. So the first thing to say about that one is, Eric, I tried my best with the accent. Hopefully it was okay.
It was certainly atmospheric, and what a strange creature.
Yeah, the Gloucester Ghoul. It's from Rhode Island in the United States. Eric's inspiration for the story comes from a piece of 19th century law related to a man called Albert Hicks, the last man prosecuted for piracy in America.
Oh, a 19th century pirate. Mm-hmm. That's quite unusual, isn't it?
It is. I mean, we have piracy today, only it tends to be less swashbuckling and salty rigging and more speedboats and AK-47s. But this story, back in 1849, a gang of treasure hunters led by Albert Hicks went looking for Captain Kidd's treasure on Page Farm on Rhode Island, but they were scared off by this eldritch horror, the Gloucester Ghoul.
That's so strange, doesn't it? A giant monster cow covered in metal plates.
It does, like the dun cow wearing armour or something. But it's been seen several times, including in 1896 and 1952. And to this day, it's said to haunt the forest not far from the Providence Turnpike.
Wow. Well, in that case, if we go back to America, we must remember, steer clear of the Providence Turnpike.
Most definitely. And thanks, Eric. Here's hoping your mobile phone never fails you again.
And now it's my turn. Five College Street, York, by Gabby Miller. December 1926. Dearest Kitty, I hope you and Tom are well. And little Charlie, of course. It's been an age since we worked together in the kitchens at Sewerby Hall. I can hardly believe I'm saying it, but I miss it, especially this time of year. It was never lonely, at least. I've been well, only I need to tell you about something that happened last week. It's nearly too horrible for words, but I must share it with someone, else I'll waste away. You remember I've been working as a medium. I learnt it from an American book, A Guide to Mediumship and Psychical Unfoldment by E.W. Wallace. It was no trouble to pick up the phrases, and a few candles and a bell didn't cost me a pound. Listening's the real trick. You listen closely enough, and people will tell you what they want to hear. That's what I used to think anyway. But now, I don't know how much longer I can do this, Kitty. And if I can't make my rent, I'll have to live with my Aunt Edith. Imagine. Well, I can't put it off any longer. Last Tuesday, I was called up by a Mrs. Baird, who'd read my advertisement in the paper. She and her husband and their little boy had just moved up from London into a house on College Street. Even writing it out sends an unholy chill down my spine. Mrs. Baird sounded nearly beside herself. Her little boy, Archie, had been seeing ghostly apparitions in his bedroom at night. His parents had spoken to his teacher and the doctor, but both said he was right as rain. I was their last resort. I'll tell you, I was over the moon. I've had so few bookings since they published that leaflet saying the Ouija board was the devil's wireless. I packed up my things and went down to College Street that very next night. Mrs. Baird met me at the door and pulled me into the house as fast as anything. She looked terrified. I thought she was worried about folks catching sight of me. Neighbours love to gossip when they hear someone's hired a medium. Now, I know it was something else. As we climbed to the first floor, I swear I felt the temperature drop. I asked Mrs. Baird if she'd left a window open, but she said it was always cold on those stairs. Archie's room was tiny, just a bed, a desk, and a small window onto the street, just the right size for a child to peek out. He was on the floor, surrounded by toy soldiers, but he wasn't playing with them. They were all turned face down on the floor, and he was sat staring at them. I knelt beside him and said, "Hello, Archie." When he turned to me, I felt a queer tingling down my spine. I've never seen a child stare like that, like he was looking through me, not at me. I took out my things and made everything ready on the small desk. Then I closed my eyes and said, like I always do, "Oh, spirits, commune with us." Straight away, something felt wrong. It was like that feeling when you miss a step going down. I felt a chill and a strange, gnawing hunger. Then I heard a wail. I thought it was Archie, but he'd barely made a squeak all evening. So I opened my eyes. I wish I hadn't, but I did. And holy God, Kitty, if you'd seen her, you'd be as mad as I am. She was standing in front of Archie's small window, a little figure with greyish, dull hair and an old sack for a dress. She was so thin, she looked more skeleton than girl. The skin on her face was stretched over her bones like wet paper over stone, like it could tear at any second. Her eyes were dark and sunken and empty. And the strangest part, the most frightening of all, was her mouth. It was open, Kitty, just hanging open, like a starving bird begging for scraps. I wanted to look away, but I couldn't. It was like I was in a trance. And then I felt a tug on my sleeve. It was little Archie looking up at me, only now he was the one with paper skin and sunken eyes. I swear, I nearly jumped out of my skin. But then I blinked, and just like that, Archie looked right again. When I looked up, the little girl was gone too. I knew right then that I was out of my depth. There was nothing I knew to do for Archie or the little girl. I told Mrs. Baird to call the vicar and leave that house as soon as they could. And then I ran. I just ran. Dearest Kitty, you must forgive me for sharing my burden with you. Only I haven't been myself since. I can't get her face out of my head, and I've barely been able to sleep or eat. I hope to God Mrs. Baird's taken Archie and left, but I won't go near College Street again. Not for love nor money. I know it's not polite to invite ourselves to stay, but I'd dearly love to come and visit you for a while. Maybe I'll get a wink of sleep with someone else in the house. Please give Tom and little Charlie my love, and write back as soon as you can. Your dear friend, Mabel.
Ooh, to borrow an excellent word we learned the other day, I'm experiencing horripilation.
Me too, what a terrifying ghost. Gabby said that her story was very loosely based on a story she heard while on one of York's ghost tours.
Oh, I'm very envious. We really want to visit York, and now we know we've got to visit 5 College Street.
Well, apparently a ghostly child has been seen staring out of an upper window of the house, which is very, very old. The legend goes that with this ghost, her parents contracted plague, and the family was bricked up in their house to prevent contamination.
Oh,
and the parents both died of plague, but the child didn't catch the plague, instead just starved to death.
Oh my God, that's horrible.
It's very tragic, but I thought Gabby did an amazing job of telling the story. I do love an epistolary story as well.
It's
great medium to tell it.
Well, thank you so much, Gabby.
Well, what have we got next?
The Lord of the Forest by Mervyn Kelly. The forest was still, quiet. Quiet, but not silent, never silent. Even now, as the sun's warmth slips beyond the horizon and the night descends over the land, the world among the trees still sings with life. The Lord of the Forest could always hear the song, but then he was part of the melody, and at times, the conductor. It had been this way since the earth first brought forth the trees. Herne moved through the forest confidently. This was, after all, his realm. He could walk here easily, either by sun or moon. He breathed deeply of the rich, moist air, the scent of the forest filling his lungs and listening to the song of the trees. It was always clearer now, at night. The world beyond the trees had become deafening. The song of the forest was all but drowned out during the daytime. The people had become so loud. Herne thought about times past when he could feel the respect the people had for the land, the trees, for all of nature, for him. He remembered when they too could hear the songs sung by the forest. He didn't know why or how the people had changed, only that they had. He would still see them walking through his land. Their voices were often harsh, speaking of strange things he didn't understand. Sometimes they would come with their tools that ripped and tore into the trees. In the times before, they would do this with care, taking only what was necessary. Now they would only leave devastation. Yes, the people were different now. Herne kept walking, softly, gently. The sounds of his movements as he brushed against the leaves hanging on the tree's branches adding to the melody around him. He could feel the strength of his bond again, sense every creature, feel his connection to all of the forest spirits. He breathed deeply once again. The night had become a time of solace after the chaos of the day. He sighed, mourning the loss of the times when the people knew their own connection with the land and the spirits that guided them. He had felt that change come upon them long ago. Herne began to feel the melancholy descend as he continued his musings. But as his thoughts darkened, he began to feel that there was something he'd missed, something small, something important. He stopped and searched carefully through his recent memory. Yes, there it was. It was so small that it had become lost within his pain. A soul had returned, an ancient soul, one he recognized. He focused on that moment, examining the details. Someone had come into the forest with a knowledge of the old ways, with a quiet respect and reverence for the trees and the creatures that lived amongst them. How could he have missed that? He reproached himself for his distraction. Had there been others he'd not noticed? Had others returned? His mind began to wander on the meaning of this. He thought on the possibilities. If more ancient souls were returning, had they come to help to heal the land and the forest? Had they come to teach again of the old ways? If they were, it would take time, a long time. Herne could wait for it all to change again. As long as there was the forest, he would be here. As long as song carried on the wind, he would be here. He found the smallest spark of hope held in that ancient soul, a spark he could breathe upon and coax into a flame to pass to the people who entered his land. This would be a great challenge, but a worthy one. Herne walked on through the forest, and his dark mood lifted more than it had in such a very long time. Feeling a hope he had thought may never be granted, he filled his lungs deeply with the heavy forest air, and after years of silence, added his voice to the song.
Oh, thanks so much for that story, Mervyn. Always good to hear a story about Herne the Hunter.
Absolutely. We love a bit of Herne the Hunter, whether that's the version from the classic kids' TV series Robin of Sherwood, or in our own take on the story, as heard on our Berkshire episode.
As we discussed back on that Berkshire episode, he's such a cool character, isn't he? The guardian of the forest with his horns and beastly aspect.
Oh, yeah, you've got to love Herne. And all the similar versions of the characters, from the old god Carnunnos to old Crocan to Edric the Wild to Odin and the Wild Hunt.
Well, there's something of the Krampus about him as well, isn't there? This kind of horned nature spirit with a bit of a demonic, devilish silhouette.
And I like the way that Mervyn's story has a kind of mournful environmental thread running through it, of the forest having been winnowed away at, and that process having diminished Herne himself somehow, giving him a faulty memory and a confused train of thought.
But an optimistic end. The idea of old souls returning and tending to the forest, reviving the old ways and giving ancient ideas and characters like Herne a chance to return.
To return. Herne.
Oh, you're terrible.
It was an open goal and I had to take it. Anyway, thanks, Mervyn. And if you see Herne trotting about and shaking his chains, do say hello to him from us.
And now it's my turn again. And I'll start spinning my yarn right after this.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Silent Sith by Viv Fraser. Good morning, dear visitor. What brings you here today? We rarely have visitors in these parts, being at the extreme end of the village and subject to the most chilling of winds. but step inside my humble abode and warm yourself by the fire. See the blankets on the hearthside chair? Take one. Wrap yourself in its woolen warp and weft. Feel its soft embrace. I might just tell you a story. So do come close. A little closer. Hardly anyone can actually hear me. I slink silently, knowingly. Only the few understand me, and I understand them. I'm alone today. My mistress is outdoors. I know not where she is, but she will come back. She always does. I'll greet her, as I usually do, brushing my soft, warm body against her legs. No, you see, I'm not a servant, or a child, or even human. Well, not anymore, anyway. But one of the finest and most agile creatures to walk the earth. Black and sleek and smooth like a piece of obsidian. Just as magical and just as old. After all, I do have 9 lives. But enough about me. Let me tell you about my mistress, the kindest, sweetest soul. Her name is Katrina, which means pure. Her hair is the richest auburn and glimmers in the firelight when she sits in her little wooden chair and reads or knits or sews to pass the long, lonely winter evenings when the sun barely rises above the horizon. Her face is pale, clear, unblemished, except for a silvery curving scar on the left of her forehead, about 1 inch long. And how did she acquire this scar, you might ask? Well, that, my friend, will be revealed. I hear a creak, a bolt lifting, a clunk of the heavy wooden front door of the cottage, shuffling, slow, heavy footsteps on the flagstones, a sniff, then a belch. I can already smell the stale smoke and liquor on his breath. My stomach turns and I feel a sudden chill. I also smell fear. My dear mistress's fear as her light, hasty footsteps fall on the path and she enters the cottage through the back door.
Where you been? And where's my supper?
The man slurs. Though man is a term I use loosely, this is Bruce, my mistress's husband, a dull, ungainly lump with a face like unleavened dough.
I've been to the baker's. Fresh bread, it's Kokoliki, your favourite. I had to run before they close, it's...
A fist slams down on the wooden table.
Useless you are, he bellows. And when are you having a burn? 2 years and nothing.
Silence. She sets the bowl of the steaming soup on the table and begins to cut a hunk of bread. I can now smell salt. Salt from the tears of my mistress as she ladles more soup into another bowl. I pass between them and rub against my mistress's legs.
And get that bloody cat out of here!
This, my friend, was a mistake. A fatal mistake. One of many. Nobody kicks Cat Sith, and nobody strikes a lady. This was the cause of the scar. I can still remember the metallic taste of the blood that dripped onto the hearth when it happened. And let me tell you, there have been bruises as well as cuts inflicted upon this gentle soul. I tried again and again to stop this. All I had to do was look. Lock eyes with that evil brute, and the task would be done. As the legend goes, look at the glowing eyes of Cat Sith, and you will never see again. Would I ever be able to do it? I had but 1 life left. I had to use it wisely. And so, one day, I took on my witch form. Disguised as a gypsy traveller, I set about my task. In the village, I offered my humble wares to all who passed. Most chose to ignore me or look upon me with contempt. My moment finally came as the familiar bulky frame shuffled towards me.
Whoa! some wool, sir? I called. I had hanks of soft, warm wool in my wicker basket, the colours of the Highlands, greens and greys and heathers. They were indeed things of beauty. He turned to me and stared into my eyes, kicked the basket and walked away. Then my eyes started to burn. It was happening. I heard a howl like I'd never heard before, then a thud. The lump had fallen to the ground. "My eyes! My eyes!" he screamed. "Idiot! Been at it again," people were saying, shaking their heads and walking away. Nobody in the village had time for Bruce, especially the publican. He writhed like an injured slug, and after a while, he was still. The villagers stared, and there was hushed whispering, before someone came to take him away. Bruce's grave was tended like the other graves out of respect, though no self-respecting cat would ever be seen there. And if you pass the spot where he fell and never walk this earth again, you can still see the faint blood stain, even after many seasons of rainfall, snow, and sun. Ah, she's home. I hear sweet singing as my mistress enters the cottage. I see her shadow on the flagstones. Yes, it is changing. Day by day, month by month. Soft, round, blooming. When the winter snows come, there'll not be one, nor two, but three in this home. Well, four if you count the family cat. This is my final home. I'm not going anywhere now. After all, a cat only has 9 lives.
I always enjoy a tale of a charming cat. Thank you so much, Viv.
Charming and ever so slightly sinister to anyone who threatens her loved ones.
Yeah, but I really enjoyed that twist, the cat taking vengeance for Catriona.
I also like that Viv picked up on one of the legends of the cat Sith, that it was actually a witch that could transform into a cat 9 times only.
Yeah, most of the cat Sith legends associate them with fairies, don't they?
Yeah, they're sort of Celtic fairy creatures who are meant to haunt the Scottish Highlands and then mostly appear as large black cats, sometimes with a white spot on their chest.
Yeah, I enjoyed that the story is narrated by the cat too, and I think Viv very much captured the sense of the fireside storyteller in Katsis's voice.
Happy ending too, which I think was more than deserved for poor Katriona.
Yeah.
Although I'm quite intrigued by her pregnancy at the end. I wonder if the cat was responsible for that too.
It's a bit of a
mystery.
Were those
fairy babies?
It was strange, wasn't it? Yeah.
All right, have you got another tale for us?
I have.
Winter's Ghost by Michelle LeBlanc. I am a ghost in winter, translucent, cold, shimmering in the moonlight, visible from just beyond the peripheral vision. My skin, once soft and kissed with summer sun as I lovingly watched over my healing garden of wolfsbane, mandrake, datura, belladonna, is cracked and cold and white. So white I could sink into the snowdrift and quietly be swallowed up, unnoticed as I blend into the mass of white, frozen crystals. My bones, once carrying me gleefully here and there as I walked among the forest, visiting the fey and woodland spirits who dwell outside the realm of mortals, feel splintered and brittle, like they could shatter as an icicle would shatter if it fell onto the rocks, forever disappearing into indistinguishable particles of ice, as if I existed nevermore. My hands. Hands that touched the soft faces and petals of my children with names of violet, snapdragon, marigold, and nasturtium are curled up and hiding like a threatened hedgehog in an English garden, too terrified to uncurl. Down deep into the folds of my tattered dress, in desperation, seeking, longing. My breath Once inhaling the smells of glorious elixirs and simmering soups and enchanted potions comes short, and it hurts. It so hurts as I exhale swirling clouds of breath like phantoms dancing a brief waltz of a party long forgotten before vanishing into the cold, thin air. My throat pains me. I am a ghost bound to winter like a hand fasting of the damned. I dwell in the darkened corner of a room inside the violated cottage that was my home. Quiet, so quiet, lest I be heard and found again. I am a whisper, an apparition, a mere glimpse of what would have come in spring, thrived in summer, and what was once glorious autumn. As my winter ghost self glides unseen past the blackened and gnarled gardens of dead flower beds where my children used to grow, I see again what they left of my cottage. The dead burnt wood rises out of the snow like standing stones of ancestors. I know that the trampled remains of my children are there somewhere. Broken little things. The crushed bones of my beloved familiar, who would curl in front of the warm fire at every chance she got, peer up at me through the dark debris and glistening frost which is now her eternal blanket. How long did you suffer, my faithful companion? My throat hurts, and I remember. I still wear their rope around my neck as they wear their crosses around theirs. My name was Mary in life, and I was cut down from the dual tree whose spirit witnessed it all on a cold morn as the sun peeked over the hill. Not alive, yet not dead, and gasping for sweet air, but only in my shattered mind. I remember raising my eyes to the moonlit sky on that first frigid night and watching with sadness and rage as my panicked wisps of breath disappeared into the night air as dandelion seeds dance in the summer breeze. As my mortal self slowly choked away, I was there when they tossed me down into my narrow grave at the crossroads. Fools, I'm not bound there. I ask myself, am I doomed to the dark half of the year, a winter's ghost to the end of time, forever tethered in death to the icy winds of sorrow? Right then, dear sisters, I say this to you. Think of me, say my name, and release me as you need. In death, I can be so useful. Call upon me and I will come. Do not forget about me, as I will surely not forget about them.
Crikey, Michelle. That one starts out all pretty and lyrical, but then it builds to a very sinister crescendo.
It does, doesn't it? I really like that about it, though. The sense of this spirit of a witch trying to see the beauty of the world, but being kind of weighed down by her pain.
And that pain manifesting itself in physical ways, the skin, the bones, the hands, the breath. But that the ghost doesn't really have a physical form, so each of those parts of her being kind of meld into nature.
And her children, her poor family.
Yeah, I mean, as if witch hunters weren't villainous enough. Now you tell me they killed the woman's familiar. Vengeance must be had.
I don't know if you ever saw the film A Ghost Story with Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara.
I didn't, but you do talk about that one quite a bit.
Yeah, well, Michelle's story reminded me a bit of that. And if you haven't seen that film, it's quite a strange one. Not a scary film at all, really, save for it's about this spirit, played by Casey Affleck, who doesn't pass on, so he ends up a ghost in a white sheet, that kind of stereotypical ghost, and follows his mourning wife back to their house. house.
I mean, that sounds more sad than scary.
Oh, it is sad because she can't see him, but she feels him there. And he kind of hangs around, bound to the house, and is bound to it even after she's moved on and new people move in. It's a mournful and uncanny kind of film.
Sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think Michelle Winter's ghost is a bit like that, bound to this burnt out cottage, waiting for purpose and to be needed. Sad, but beautiful.
My go now.
Yeah, take it away.
The Weeping Willow by Estella Bellicki. The willow tree had stood on the edge of Hartley Village Green for many hundreds of years, and it was always a view I can remember seeing from my grandparents' house. It provided shade in the summer, rattled away with the breeze in the autumn, and looked lonesome in the winter. The house was an 18th century cottage with four bedrooms, two looking out over the front of the property and the green. My grandparents had bought the property as newlyweds in the 1950s. My mum and her siblings had grown up here, and it always had a welcoming but drafty atmosphere. So it's fair to say they knew Hartley and its residents inside and out. Their neighbour Susan had lived there for a similar amount of time and had known the family most of our lives. She was a kind-hearted woman, with a curly white perm and twinkling blue eyes. She could put you at ease in a heartbeat. I would always stay in the small front bedroom. A single iron daybed was under the floral curtain-framed window, and beside the bedstead was a small table lamp with a dim watt bulb, hanging above a painting of two horses in a field grazing, with an iron heater for warmth. It was a lovely little room. To me, it had always provided the right feeling of magical escapism from everyday life. Ever since I can remember, I could always hear a low, humming, crying-like noise when I stayed with them. I mentioned it to them many a time, of course, but my grandmother said, "Oh, it's an old house. It could be air in the pipes, the wind in the brickwork cracks, or just noise carried across the village." But every time I stayed, it seemed the noise got louder. On a cold January night at 11 o'clock, I was wide awake because of it. The room was, of course, cosy as usual, but the noise was unbearable. Unable to sleep, I sat up and looked out of the window, pulling back the curtain. I could make out the willow's presence with the moonlight beating down on it, but below the tree there was a figure. I rubbed my eyes and checked again, and yes, there was someone there. Who would be mad enough to be out at this time of night in this temperature? I asked myself. I couldn't take my eyes off the lonely figure. Something about them seemed to transfix me. And all of a sudden, the crying was making my ears ring with pain. I put my hands over my ears and had to pull my view away. The ache was throbbing, but curiosity made me look up. The figure seemed more established this time, with a curvy figure and long skirts blowing in the wind. And still, the crying continued. Something told me to get up and go out to check if the woman was okay. It was very concerning seeing her outside in the cold with this awful noise going on. Could she hear it too? Was the terrible noise affecting her so badly that she couldn't move? Quickly, I jumped off the bed and put on my boots and coat. I made my way down the creaky wooden staircase, along the hallway, and turned the key, unlocking the great wooden front door. Once outside, I closed the door slowly behind me and made my way cautiously down the path and through the iron gate. All this time, I kept my eyes on the woman. The crying was still penetrating my ears, and as I made my way across the green toward the willow tree, there she was. A figure with dark hair stood before me, with tears streaming down her face in a long black dress. Her brown eyes met mine. "Are you okay?" I said, my hands still covering my ears. She went to speak, but as her mouth opened, the piercing cry came out. Upon hearing this, I closed my eyes and blocked my ears. It was awful. That's all I can remember. The next thing I knew, I was being tapped on the shoulder. I awoke lying on the grass under the willow tree early the next morning. Susan, my grandparents' neighbour, was bent down in front of me, asking, "Are you all right? Why are you out here at this time of the morning?" I was perplexed. Susan took my hands and led me back into her house. Sitting at her kitchen table and clutching a warm mug of tea, I told Susan of my encounter with the woman beneath the willow tree. To my surprise, she seemed calm and collected. And when I finished, she said, "I've heard the legend of the Hartley Weeping Willow. A select few can see and hear her. A young couple in the Victorian times were courting and would pass time together under the willow tree, enjoying picnics in the summer and sheltering from showers in the autumn. One day, he had to go off to fight in the Crimean War. He promised her on his return they would wed below the mighty tree. He went off to war, and every day she would wait under the willow for his return. One fateful January night, she received a telegram. She believed it was news of her beau's return, but sadly, it contained devastating news of his death. Of course, she didn't believe this and went to wait under the willow tree. It was bitingly cold on this night, and she wept continuously for the loss of her love. The next morning, under the tree she was found. She'd gotten too cold, caught hypothermia and died. It's said that although she was buried in the churchyard, her spirit never got over losing her love, and her cries can be heard to this day. And that's how the Weeping Willow of Hartley was born."
Another one for the horripilation there, Estella. But I also might have just a little something in my eye.
Yeah, that turned into quite a twist from this eerie build-up to this very sad ending. Mm-hmm. The idea of the poor ghost dying of cold while waiting for her love.
I could really picture the room in which the narrator stayed
as
well.
Yeah, me too. It reminded me of the room I stayed in when I used to go stay with my grandparents as a child.
I thought Stella captured that idea of coming to stay in a grandparent's house and it being like a time capsule.
Yeah, the heater and the painting of the horses. I also really like stories about trees, which are very much local landmarks, being conflated with these stories of people. So much so that people have actually turned into trees.
Oh, yes, like the story of the witch's leg.
Yeah.
You know, the tree growing out of the church in Norfolk you told me about, which is supposed to be a buried wooden leg belonging to a witch.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot of folklore surrounding specifically willow trees as well, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, they're linked to Hecate, goddess of the underworld, and are also associated with water.
Orpheus also carried willow branches on his adventures in the underworld, and his lyre was carved from willow.
Well, in Celtic tree astrology, we're almost in the willow month, which runs from the 15th of April to the 12th of May. Willow in Celtic mythology is associated with the moon and water, and also fertility, new life and spirituality.
Oh, well, the story was perfectly in time for willow month, wasn't it? Thank you so much, Estella. We really enjoyed that one.
Right, my go again, and our last one for today. The Knock by Ian Tovey. It is night. I lie in my hovel in a cold sweat. Every creak of the elm tree that stands behind my home sends a shiver of fear down my back. It has been like this for 7 long years and will be like this until the day I die. As boys, Gervaise and I had always run wild. Scrumping and poaching had turned into petty theft, and worse. But we lived charmed lives. We were protected. Not by spells, witchcraft, or amulets, I hasten to add. We had no dealings with the devil or his acolytes. We were protected by an accident of birth. Although I'm from humble stock, my father is the village smith, Gervaise was the son of our lord of the manor, a spoiled and indulged boy who got what he wanted and took what he fancied with no fear for the consequences.
When we were 16, Gervaise took it into his head that he should emulate that great folk hero Robin Hood with one small twist. Whatever he took from the rich, he would keep. Gervaise decided that we should start small, and so our first victim would be our parish priest, who was never short of a penny or two. Father Bernard was an old man, well-liked in the village and surrounding countryside, popular with the gentry, farmers and serfs alike. He was also well-known for his love of Mother Watkins' home-brewed ale. We lay in wait for him in the dark of the night, amongst the bushes that lined the lane leading from Mother Watkins' house. At Gervaise's insistence, we'd covered our faces with scarves. As Father Bernard staggered by, hiccuping quietly, we grabbed him from behind, thinking him to be an easy mark. Who would have expected him to put up such a fight? Maybe the ale had given him courage, who can tell? At the first sound of our clumsy approach, Father Bernard lashed out with his staff, catching me a blow to the left temple, and I fell like a pole-axed mule. Having put me out of the fight, he grabbed Gervaise, dragging the scarf from his face. I saw a knife flash in the moonlight, and before I could cry out a warning, Father Bernard was lying beside me, blood oozing from between his fingers. Of Gervaise, there was no sign. Father Bernard survived, but despite getting a clear view of his assailant, I was the only one brought to trial. I suspect that Gervaise's father bought the old priest off. I was sentenced to hang, but as luck would have it, ill luck, the devil's luck in my opinion, our king was recruiting men for a crusade in the Holy Land, and so I was absolved of my crime and took the cross. I will not dwell on the misery of that portion of my life. I will not talk of the burning heat, the thirst, hunger, and atrocities committed by both sides in the name of religion and a loving God. Neither will I tell of my years of torment after I was captured, except to say that it was then that I met Fatima, a woman who gave me more love and affection than I ever expected to receive or deserve. I gained my freedom and lost Fatima after a raid by the Knights Hospitaller and made my weary way back home. Here I discovered that Gervaise was now Lord of the Manor after his father's death. To see the man whose cowardice had robbed me of my freedom, lording it over my friends and neighbours, made my blood boil, and we argued frequently, though we never quite came to blows. Things finally brewed to a head during the Harvest Festival, where we argued again about his petty and vindictive treatment of his tenants. "I will not be hectored by a common criminal," he remarked icily. "You bastard," I yelled in a fit of passion. "You owe me my life." Later that evening, I slipped something into his drink when no one was looking, a concoction I learned about from my beloved Fatima, an expert with potions, filters, and poisons. Gervaise died that night in agony, and although most of the village suspected that I'd had a hand in his death, no one pointed a finger or spoke out against me. Gervaise was buried in his family vault, and for a while, life returned to normal. It was on All Hallows Eve that my troubles started. I was awoken in the middle of the night by a knocking on my door. I opened it to find Gervaise there, his face expressionless and dead white in the moonlight. Before I could shut the door, he grabbed me and we fought. For someone who'd been dead and buried for weeks, Gervaise was remarkably strong, but years spent living in a harsh environment, performing hard manual labor, had honed my body. Fear and anger gave me a strength I did not know I possessed, and I fought him like a madman. I realized that each blow caused Gervaise's body to shrink. I continued to beat him until he was small enough to pick up, and then I squeezed him between my hands until he was no larger than a pebble. What was I to do? I slipped from my home and made my way to an abandoned sand working. I scooped out a shallow depression, dropped Gervais into it, then pushed him deeper with a pole cut from a pollarded willow. Finally, I placed a large rock over the spot to keep him down. But did I do enough? I did not confine Gervais in a vessel. I said no prayers. What if someone, in their ignorance, removes this rock and releases him? Will he come back seeking vengeance? It's night. I lie in my hovel in a cold sweat, fearing the time that I hear that fateful knocking at my door.
Blimey, well, that story's more like a saga than a short tale.
It is. I mean, Ian, that narrative could easily be a novel. You had teenagers mugging a priest, a trial, a crusade, a marriage to some kind of Middle Eastern witch, then a return and revenge story. And it's the end of the tale, actually, that I like the most.
Yeah, all of that crammed into 1,000 words.
It's
and frankly, what's not to like? You've got a nasty villain who gets smaller the more you fight him.
Yes.
And that is very folkloric, especially in the sense that it seems the narrator can't actually truly defeat the villain, so he's always going to come back.
And to me, that idea works particularly well because that dynamic is symbolic of guilt. It's like the narrator can bash the guilt back into its box, minimise it or bury it in the ground, but sooner or later it's going to grow back out again and come knocking at your door.
Well, you could see it as guilt, or similarly you could see it as trauma, couldn't you?
Yeah, that's very true. And Ian's poor narrator certainly has had his share of trauma.
That's for sure. I mean, I do think it would be worth Ian taking the time to develop that story, write out the chapters of the adventure and so on, because there's something of the inverse Rumpelstiltskin to it in the end. Rather than getting smaller and smaller as Rumpelstiltskin gets angrier,
yes,
or in some versions tears himself to pieces,
yes,
the implication of the story is that Gervais, the evil Lord, is going to get bigger and bigger.
And Ian leaves things on a cliffhanger. He only had 1,000 words after all. But you can almost imagine a continuation of the story where Gervais, representing this ghostly trauma or guilt, gets bigger and bigger and becomes gigantic.
But how will he then be overcome?
Well, that's the thing about guilt or trauma. You have to learn to live with it, to integrate those things into life. So I think that he would probably need to teach Gervais to be a better person and come to maybe even eventually befriend him.
I would absolutely read that book.
Yeah, me too. So there you go, Ian. Thanks for your flash fiction story. Now turn it into a novel just to please us.
Please don't feel you have to. I've just finished a first draft of a book and it took me months.
Yeah, but you got there. Very excitingly.
Anyway, well done to Eric, Gabby, Mervyn, Viv, Michelle, Stella and Ian, and thank you so much for writing cracking stories and for being runners-up in our Folky Flash Fiction competition.
Most definitely. And dear listener, do please show them some love on social media. As any writer will tell you, positive feedback and encouragement is like manna from heaven, and we want all 7 of these wonderful writers to keep putting pen to paper.
We will, of course, be back next week with our 7 winning stories, but as usual, you can email us at 3ravenspodcast@gmail.com. Please send us things for our next listener episode, and do join us on social media if you haven't already at facebook.com/3ravenspodcast, Instagram @3ravenspodcast, or X@3ravenspod.
And of course, we have our brand new Patreon exclusive episode coming out on Thursday about 3 lost villages from our home county of Sussex. So if you're interested in that and would like to support the podcast while also unlocking tons of exclusive content, please sign up to our Patreon for $3 a month or $6 a month at patreon.com/3ravenspodcast.
In the meantime, though, while your stories have gone that way, we'll go this way.
And remember, don't whistle until you're out of the woods.
Our theme song is the traditional folk ballad Three Ravens, performed by Eleanor Conlon and Ben Harbour, and our logo is by Ollie James Dare.
The Three Ravens podcast is a Rust and Stardust production, produced by me, Martin Vaughs. Thanks for listening.
God send every gentleman. such hounds, such hawks, and such leman, with a down, derry, 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 down, down.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.